Muriel Gardner, Reel 4. Yes, you were saying about this real danger, really, that your husband could be abducted.
Yes, yes, and he could. The sort of irony it was that of all the people in UNRWA, I suppose my husband was the one who stuck up to the Russians the most and battled against them the most, and that he was the one who in his own politics was very socialist and left in his politics, and he was the one who could see some sense in communism if it was properly administered in its ideal form. I mean, and yet he was the one of all UNRWA who was the one who was prepared to battle against the Russians in this taking off of people.
So you were saying about all the trades and crafts. The people were obviously kept very busy then. Was that important to keep them, you know, active and engaged?
Oh, yes, it was terribly important because the only way really to keep the camp free of trouble is to have everybody working purposefully upon some worthwhile job. And we had an instance, really, of that when we hadn't been there all that long, when we noticed that it was the first people who worked for the will, even though there was so much misery about the camp and the people were in such a parlous state. Nevertheless, the whole atmosphere of the camp was euphoric, even in the early days, because here they were free after years of slavery. And so the atmosphere was euphoric, and everybody was willing to put their backs into things and tidy up and clean up, and there was no resentment at all. And then after a couple of months, we noticed a change in the atmosphere of the camp, and we become very conscious of the least change in feeling in a refugee camp. And we noticed that people were hanging about in groups, and that they were grumbling, and people were saying, why should we do all this dirty work? Why should we clean out these latrines? The Germans have had us slaving for them for years. Why don't they, UNRWA, get the Germans to do this work for us? So we thought, well, fair enough, why don't we? And so we got the Germans, the military government, to release German prisoners of war to us. Well, this was disastrous, because one thing, they came in on the military escort, so they had the military presence in the camp, and all that we could see is they could see that the same number of returners came in. The Germans worked slovenly fashion, and they were very loath to do any more than they need, and you could hear them muttering to each other, filthy foreigners. And with the displaced persons, if they found a German on his own with nobody looking, would take a punch at him or get their own back. And we were very often put in a position of seeming to defend the Germans against our own people. So this was disastrous. And so my husband said, well, somehow we must get these people to want to work again. And having been in the Ministry of Labour, he had a great work ethic. And so he said, I know what we will do. We will set up a rational system. And he said, for every week's work that a man or woman does in camp, on camp jobs, we will give 50 work points. And he said, that can be your job. I never want to set up a rational system again. Because not only have you to give work points to the people who can work, you've got work points, bonus points to give to the sick and the infirm, and the women with children, and so on. And it was a tremendous job. But then one has to backtrack a little, because as soon as the war was over, the army released to us the prisoner of war parcels. And the most favoured prisoner of war parcels were the Americans, which had the most cigarettes in and the most coffee. And next to that were the British. And then you had Indian parcels full of curries and highly spiced foods, which you didn't like. And the least favoured were the invalid prisoner of war parcels, where you got all mushy food and so on. Well, a lot of the camps, the easy way of doing things was, when you got these parcels, was to give one parcel to one person and say, that is your rations for a fortnight, and leave it to them. But these parcels had an enormous black market value in Germany. And so we didn't do that, partly for that reason, and partly to give people work. So we took over an old stable that was badly blitzed, and we processed these parcels. We put them through a conveyor belt system, and we broke them down. So the parcel would be opened at one end of the system, and it would be pushed along, and one man would take out all the meat and stack it, and another man would take out all the butter, and it was pushed along, and another took out the sugar, and so on. And originally this was done to keep back the cigarettes and the coffee, because these were the most cherished items. Originally it was to pay the people who were doing very dirty work in cigarettes in the camp. But when the German economy broke down, as it did completely, money was of no use, and you were back to bartering in kind. And so the cigarette became the unit of currency in the very badly blitzed areas of Germany. So if you went to a hairdresser in Germany, you didn't take money, you took a briquette of coal and two cigarettes. Nobody ever smoked the cigarettes because they were too precious. It was all such a fantastic a situation. So the cigarettes were very important. And so my husband said, with these cigarettes and coffee that we've hoarded, we will send our trucks out into the parts of Germany which have not been so ravaged with war, and we will buy in all the goods that we need. Because these people had nothing. No pins, no needles, no sewing cloth, no toothbrushes, no toothpaste, no soap. No, none of the basic things of life that one takes for granted did they have. And so these things were essential to them. So he said, we will bring these things in, and we will set up a shop, and they will be able to buy these goods, not for money, but for work points. Well, as soon as this system got going, of course, it went like a bomb, because everybody was queuing up at the national bureaus, or queuing up huge queues, pleading for this work, to get these precious work points, to get these goods that they so badly needed. And so we set up a sort of hypermarket, and we got it made very attractive. We put a Latin in charge of it, and they made it very attractive with coloured shelves and so on, and they made coloured bits, so you would have a toothbrush with two against it, and that meant two work points. And the people enjoyed shopping there because it was an attractive sort of shop. And really sidetracked onto another story, perhaps I will put in at the end. And so the system went like a bomb, and everybody was happy and everybody was working. So when you went into the camp, nobody was hanging about the squares. Everybody was walking about purposefully with some object in view. And the camp again picked up. But then, of course, sooner or later, the prisoner of war parcels were used up, and no more came in. And so my husband said, somehow we must keep this work system going. And so he went into Perda for a couple of days, and he came up with another brilliant idea. And he said, what we will do is, we will send people into the ruins of Frankfurt, because Frankfurt am Main was very badly blitzed round about the Christmas. And he said, so he loaded up some about six Russians and Poles who worked in the cinematograph industry, and he sent them down into the ruins of Frankfurt, and he said, find a cinema and bring in any equipment that you think you can repair, which they did, and we will set up a cinema. And so, unknown to us, they made several other journeys, and they brought all the red plush tip-up seats as well, so we had a wonderful cinema. And I could get plenty of films from the American Army, of course, old Charlie Chaplin's and so on. And so we set up the cinema. Now, as part of the war reparations, Germany was forced to pay the displaced persons a pittance. It was only a pittance. And the Burgermeister came in and each Friday, and he paid over this money. Now, it would have been very easy for my husband, as commandant, to have said, I will keep 1%, 2%, 3% of this money for the camp fund. Because at any time, were we given any goods or equipment by the army, nor were we paid and our salaries were paid into banks in this country. So we had no money, and all equipment had to be begged, borrowed, or scrounged. But the displaced persons did have this mere pittance. And if my husband had kept that 1 or 2% for a camp fund, sooner or later this would have caused resentment, because somebody would have found out and said, they are keeping our money. And so this would cause resentment. So this scheme was very much better. So he set up this cinema, and they paid over their money to see the films, and we took the money, and we at last had a camp fund where we could keep our goods going and keep buying in the goods from the parts of Germany which hadn't been touched by war at all and where the currency was still operating. And so that was a great success. And from 10 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock at night when it closed, the cinema always had a queue in front of it of people who were off duty waiting to spend their money on seeing these films. And I think when I was setting up this this shop to display these films, we had two American ladies, socialites from New York, who came in with the American Red Cross. And when we set up workshops for the people, then partly to provide tables and chairs and school desks for the camp originally, but we started to set up these workshops. They came in with some machines for the Red Cross, and they stayed with us for 3 months to see to the setting up of these machines and forming a separate little workshop for the sort of dedicated to the Red Cross. And there they were. So my husband called me in one day, and he said, "What's all this?" He said, "I just had Mrs. Green in." And he said, "She's complaining that you're setting up workshops in opposition to her." And so I said, "I'm not setting up workshops. What do you have to do without thinking of workshops?" So he said, "Well, she overheard you talking to Coolitas and saying that you wanted the shop to look pleasant and a place that people would enjoy going into." She said, "As if hers are not pleasant." So I said, "Very, the penny dropped." And I said, "What I was talking to Coolitas is about this shop for the sale of these goods that we are showing for the work points." And I said, "I wanted an attractive place." So he said, "Well, I'll have Mrs. Green in then." So Mrs. Green came in and explained to her that I was setting up this shop. She said to me, "Well, you shouldn't have said shop, you should have said store." It just shows how two nations are divided by one language. this we found continually with the Americans, of course. You would come in to breakfast and say you're full of beans, and there'd be horror, because, of course, the Americans, it's full of wind and things like that. But in actual fact, of course, many of the Americans' words are still our own 16th century English. I mean, they're fall for autumn, and they're attorneys, they're a solicitor. They're all the real old English words. It's we who have transgressed, and they who keep the old words. So that dispelled this feeling of resentment that crept into the camp. After that, it was a happy camp, busily working, and those systems were still operating when we left.
How are you coping for things like clothes for the DPs and shoes?
Well, again, they mainly acquired their own, quite frankly. But when we, in the early days, I mean, they went out foraging, and they persuaded people to give them clothes and things. And they were. But when you come down to it, there's very little difference. We were allowed to requisition from the Germans, but if they requisitioned from the Germans, it was stealing. And in the British zone, this was clamped down upon them, and there was always trouble in the British zone. So the British, the displaced persons, were nothing but a nuisance because they didn't comply with the rules. They were put into camps, and they were guards on the gates. They had nothing to do because the army did it all. Therefore, there was always trouble in the camps of the British zone, and the displaced persons were a thorn in the side of the British zone people, simply because they didn't give them enough to do. The army did everything for them, and that's just about the worst possible thing. So now in all that, I've forgotten your question.
Yes, it was about the clothing. I wondered if you had these bundles from sent over.
At first, you didn't inquire where they got their clothes from, but they managed to get rid of their concentration camp clothes and they got the clothes sold. And then, of course, when we started the workshops up, we started a tailoring and dressmaking shop, where if we got any, managed to scrounge any material from the German factories, then we could put them in into our own workshops and make up clothes, and we made up uniforms for the scouts and things like that. So that was one of the 15 workshops that we had operating in the camp. We had blacksmith shops and electrical shops and so on. But in addition to that, sometimes you would get an import from, say, people like Save the Children Fund or the Red Cross or those sort of charity organisations. You'd get in cartloads of second-hand clothing. And while I'm not denigrating the work of Save the Children Fund, and this clothing is needed in the camps, but it is a pain in the neck to distribute. It caused endless dissension. Because how do you equate giving one woman a fur coat and the next woman a threadbare tweed coat? It caused endless trouble. But once the rationing system got going and we put this clothing on work points, then peace was restored. There was no resentment at all. If Mrs. Popoff wanted to spend 6 work points on a fur coat when she got a tweed coat for 2 work points, more for her. And so everybody was very happy. But the distribution of clothing before that was really rather headache. And you would get some stupid man called Kaiser, I think, in the American, in America, had the idea of sending trucks through the streets and people threw in shoes. Well, of course, the shoes started life tied together in America, but by the time they got to us, they weren't tied together, and so we got truckloads of single shoes to sort out. And mainly that was sent to the workshops, to the doll making shop where they could use up a bit of this. But that was the only clothing that we were actually sort of ever given.
So it sounds as if, you know, it was more or less a little self-supporting entity during your time there as it developed.
Yes.
Were you getting more people in to help you? You know, your little team of four, were you?
The team of four, for the first 3 months we were lost. Because we sent us off to ground, they were one of their most sort of travelers. So it was an idea where we were. But we didn't know where we were lost, so we went on busily working. But after about 5 months, we were sent 2 more people, so our team was augmented to 6. And then we got instructions that we could, if we liked, recommend certain displaced persons to be taken on as second-class armoured personnel. And they would be put into uniform, and they would be paid some sort of salary by UNRWA. And so we recruited about 12 from our camp were recruited in this way. So we finished up after 2 years with a camp with a team of about 17 people, 17 or 18 people, which really wasn't very much to run even a camp of 6,000, 7,000 people. But it helped enormously. And we had great fun sometimes doing these applications. We had a Latvian, Mr. Bergs, who was the bank manager in Latvia. And he always looked keen and smart, even in the dreadful conditions of the refugee camp. He always managed to look neat. And Mr. Bergs, we put in charge of our office block. And so he was being put up to be an UNRWA second-class personnel. And his Latvian secretary, Laura, who spoke quite good English, and she filled in his application form for him. And under the previous occupation, when it came to me, she had got procurer. But anybody less like a procurer than Mr. Bergs, I couldn't imagine. So I said to her, Laura, where did you get this word from? So she said, well, I looked it up in the dictionary, and it said, somebody who manages somebody else's affairs. And I said, yes, Laura, but that affairs have got an eon, and that made all the difference in the world. And we were always getting into tangles with language like this. So a Latvian engineer would send his report into you, and it would say, the main drain outside block 5 is again constipated. Well, you knew what he meant. He looked up blocked, and that's what he got. But this was a constant sort of amusement in the camp, and we were always making all sorts of mistakes like this. The doctor, when he in camp, camp of 10,000 people is a very, very noisy place. And he couldn't get, when he set up his hospital, he couldn't get quiet for his night nurses to get sleep during the day. So with displaced persons labour, he built on the edge of the camp a little dormitory where they could get sleep during the day in peace. And he threw a party to celebrate the opening of this lounge, as he called it. And so he had his invitations printed. He actually found a printing press in Hanau that was still working. And so he had his invitations printed. And on one side he had in French, you're invited to the opening of a medical lounge. And across the middle he had on Supera, on Dansera, on Accueillera, Joyeuse Mont, La Nouvelle Année, it happened to be New Year. And on his English translation was, you're invited to the opening of a medical lounge, and across the middle, supper, dancing, intimacy. And of course, these invitations had gone out to the American army, and so they came full of expectations. It went down history as the intimacy party. And after that, he kept bringing us books which said they were intimate friends, or he was intimate with his subject. And we had to say, well, doctor, unless you're British, leave it alone. Might be right, it might be wrong. So this was continually happening. The Latvian chief came to me one day and he said, madam, we would like to build a children's garden. And I thought, what a very good idea. There's plenty of land at the back of the camp where it petered out into the forest. And if the children could grow flowers and vegetables, that's a nice idea. So I said, yes, I think it's a very good idea, Mr. Corse. Get on with it. And so he said, well, will you come and open it on such and such a day? So I said, yes. So I turned up on this particular day. And they took me in, the teachers met me, they took me in, they gave me a cup of cocoa and rum. And then some children came in and they sang for me, and some children came in and they danced for me. And I was very busy then, and kept looking at my watch. And eventually I said, Mr. Corse, do you think we could go now and see the children's garden? And so he said, he looked in astonishment at me, and he said, but darling, this is it, you are seeing it, this is the children's garden. I realised, of course, he translated kindergarten for me. And so it went on.
You were saying about uniforms made for the scouts. Did you set up scouts
yes,
and guides?
Right, yes, from a purely altruistic motive, really, a selfish motive. In the early days, I hadn't people to run messages for me. There were only four of us, and it was a big camp. And therefore, I wanted people to do odd jobs and take messages. So I thought, well, I'll start some scouts and guides, because they can do messages for me. So for this purely wrong reason, I started up scouts and guides. And we had one Polish boy, whom we made scout master, who actually had kept a Polish scout badge all the time in the concentration camps. He said sometimes he'd had to hide it under his tongue when he was being searched, but he'd got his scout badge. But nobody else had. So in the workshops, when we set up a metal workshop, we made scout badges of our scouts, and we finished up with about 600 scouts. And the Latvian scouts held two big jamborees in Hanau when the scouts from other camps came. And we had days of jamborees that set up little tents for them and so on. What else I was going to say then, but it's gone out of my mind.
Did you have guides and brownies too?
Yes, we had guides and brownies and scouts. Yes. The Polish scouts tended to be rather military. And my husband lost 2 stone in the first 6 months, because we all got dysentery very badly, and he got it worse than anybody else. And so the American doctors insisted that Anwar send him home. I was given compensatory leave, so he was sent home for 9 days, and we came back to this country. And we went to Buckingham Palace, and we also visited the Lithuanian ambassador in London with news of the camp, because of course Britain and the United States were still regarding the Baltic states as independent and not acknowledging the occupation of Russia. So we visited him, and we also visited Scouts headquarters in Buckingham Palace Road and persuaded them to give us some books on scouting to try and get the Polish Scouts back to the ideals of Baden-Powell, because they were very, very military, and really their Scouts were almost like the ATC. They were they kept where the Scouts lived in separate barracks and so on. And, so we tried to get them back to scouting as we knew it. And then on one occasion, at one of these jamborees, they decided to make me chief scout. And they had an enormous bonfire as high as a house, and it was in a dell, so that people could be on the massed on the sides of the dell and accommodated quite a lot of people. And they gave me a huge flare to light this bonfire with. Now, I had been brought up as a guide in this country, and you didn't use artificial aids to light fires. And so when I plunged this great flare into the bonfire, of course I didn't know they doused it with petrol, and it whooshed, and I nearly had a barbecue chief scout. I lost all my eyebrows, all the hairs on my arms were singed, and I managed to retreat more or less on scale. It wasn't a very dignified chief scout, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Did you find these children, you know, they'd obviously had terrible ordeals, a lot of them, particularly those who'd been in the camps, like your little boy, who hid the badge. How easy was it for them to recover and become normal children again? Did you get any idea of this? How quickly they adapted?
Yes, I suppose on the face of it, people recovered, children and adults, very quickly. Human nature is very resilient. And on the face of it, they recovered comparatively quickly. But it was a thin crust, and the least thing would disrupt it. So, for instance, the first Christmas, we decided that all children should have at least two good toys in camp. And so we'd no method, of course, with no money to buy toys. So again, we sent men down into the ruins of Frankfort, and they brought back toys, and they repaired them and painted them up in the camp workshop. So every child had at least two good toys for the first Christmas. And we started with the Poles, because Christmas was a dreadful time in camp, because the Poles start giving presents on December the 6th, Nicholas Day, and then you get all the Hungarians and the Balts and the Yugoslavs, the Italians, and people like us who celebrate on the 25th of December, and you finish with the Russians who still keep the old calendar and celebrate on the 8th of January. And so we started with the Poles, and we took over the Russian theatre, and we had about 100 Polish children. We had about 350 children in camp, and about 100 Polish children assembled. Well, unknown to me, the Continental Father Christmas is not a bit our Father Christmas, who's a jolly, rubicund fellow. He is Nicholas, and he represents good, and he is always accompanied by two horrible little black-faced creatures called doppelgangers, who have birches, and they are bad. So it's the good and the evil in mankind. And St. Nicholas started off by giving a homily that he'd got presents for the good boys and girls, but he'd got a birch for the bad boys and girls. Well, here you have children who had seen their parents beaten in concentration camps and slave labor camps. So immediately, the birch was mentioned, well, it was pandemonium. These children, you had hysterical children screaming their heads off. Of course, in Poland, they would have known that this was all part of the fun of Christmas and that they were going to get their presents. But here, they'd seen their parents ill-treated. You got this breakdown of this very thin veneer. So it was very easily, came to the surface, the least thing. And you found this with the adults as well. You see the traffic.